Okay, well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. In particular, because I realized both last night and this morning, there's a whole lot of people here who've done a lot of extraordinary research, and I've been fortunate to draw on that. So it's a wonderful group to be speaking to. I want to talk a little bit about just to give you a glimpse of what we call civil forfeiture regulation in Canada. The only kind of, you might draw something from the last four slides, which are actually about this little project that we're running, but I thought I would begin by run through what the actual civil forfeiture mechanism is and a little bit about how it works in Canada. So just to begin the forfeiture landscape, we actually have forfeiture running under both federal and under provincial regulation. The federal regulation, of course, that's the criminal stuff. So there are aspects of non-conviction-based taking of assets under criminal law, under the federal regulation, as much as there are under the provincial regulation. And in the federal context, it's largely under the criminal code. We have it under, everybody has these sort of money laundering, anti-terrorist finance laws, also under your classic drugs and controlled substances laws. All of that's under criminal jurisdiction. And we also have the provincial ones, which are classically under provincial constitutional jurisdiction under property and civil rights. So they're not criminal, allegedly. They're about property and civil rights. And we have about, as far as I know, we have eight provinces that actually have this kind of legislation, which, of course, if you encounter Canadian jurisdiction, it's a mess, right? Because you think it's one big jurisdiction, and there's not a whole lot of assets that go through there, but you have to begin to negotiate we have more than eight jurisdictions, but if you're going after civilly going after assets, you're going to encounter one of eight different regimes. They're substantially similar, but there are some differences, so it makes it rather annoying. Okay, so I just wanted to look at to give you a sense of what one of them is, and this is, I'm going to draw on the civil one, called Criminal Forfeiture of Property Act. This is the Manitoba one. Like I said, they're all largely similar. So there's some weird pieces in the context of Quebec, because, I don't know, you may or may not know this, Quebec is a very, very weird, anomalous jurisdiction. It's allegedly a civil code jurisdiction operating in allegedly a common law country. So the civil legislation in Quebec is very, very different, but the other ones are substantially similar. So most of our provinces have something like this. Something like it's either called the Civil Property Forfeiture Act. In Alberta, it used to be called the Restitution Act, so they can be hard to find. But in any event, this is the kind of powers that we generally seem to have. The director of this office has the powers to bring two kinds of actions. One an action is to forfeit the proceeds of crime, and the other an action to forfeit the instruments of crime. I know that the proceeds of crime actions are quite common everywhere, just going after money derived from X, Y, Z number of crimes. Instruments provisions are a little bit weird and different. I think we must have drawn on the United States, because I certainly know that most jurisdictions do not seem to have a power to instrument, a broad power to take the instruments of crime. We have derived ours in looking at what the United States had done, so we have a power to take things that are used, what comes in the next slide, things that are used in connection with offenses. So we have what are the proceeds of unlawful activity? That's like in most jurisdictions, the proceeds of crime, right? They're defined specifically by reference to federal criminal legislation. So you can't really make the argument that we're actually going after non-criminal stuff, right? Restitutionary stuff, going after debts. Everything is defined under this legislation, even though you're using a civil mechanism. It's all classically what you would understand to be crimes, which introduces an interesting dimension in the context of taxation law, because there are real questions about, we have a crime of tax evasion, and therefore the crime of tax evasion would fit under this regime. There's great reluctance to use this mechanism to go after the proceeds of the crime of tax evasion, because we also have, as you're aware, in the context of taxation, you have crimes of tax evasion, and you also have tax avoidance. Well, under this legislation, what most of us do to avoid taxes would actually create seizable revenues that could be seized under provincial legislation for the failure to pay your appropriate taxes. So what we have here is a property proceeds of crime derived classically from criminal offenses. The instruments of crime, this is a piece, like I said, this is a piece that some jurisdictions have. We certainly have it. allows you to take instruments connected to the commission of offenses. The only piece I would draw your attention to, at least in the Canadian context, it's rather different again, is this one. Instruments likely used in the acquisition of property, there's no problem with that. But in Manitoba and a few other jurisdictions, we also have this, seizing the property that was caused or likely to cause serious bodily harm. So in that context, what you have is property seized as an instrument of an offense, such as an assault. So we have a famous case that involved an assault. The assault occurred in the house. They took the house as the, not as the proceeds, but as the instrument of the offense. So we have that. A number of jurisdictions have that provision. So come back to that in a second. So we also have, so just to give you a sense of how this stuff works, obviously it's non-conviction based. Nobody needs to ever be convicted of an offense. Everything's done on the balance of proof, balance of probabilities, right? We also have administrative forfeiture, so basically we can take your stuff, and if you don't show up and if the value is less than $7,500, we don't have to do anything. We don't even have to prove on a balance of probabilities. We've just taken your stuff and the game is over. One of the saving provisions, though, and I say this because whereas most jurisdictions have some kind of proceeds of crime, now some kind of civil proceeds of crime, one of the things that we have in Canadian constitutional, that's a bit of a saving provision, is we have this idea that if we took your stuff, the judges have a residual discretion under this legislation to deny the taking or to refuse the taking if they see that it would not, clearly not be in the interest of justice to do so. So basically the idea there is there's something that's built into legislative regime, even if we prove on a balance of probability some commission of some crime, this is connected to it, the judges have this ability right in the statute to say, no, we're not going to allow the state to go ahead in this particular case. So that's the basics. With respect to constitutional concerns, which, as you know, in all jurisdictions, these come up, we have two constitutional concerns with respect to any kind of forfeiture legislation that comes up. Well, we animate any case in Canada are animated by two constitutional frameworks of arguments. One is the jurisdictional one. In Canada, we have, of course, jurisdictions split. Provinces can do some things. Feds can do some things. So in the context of civil forfeiture regulation, the first debate that we had that came up was, does civil forfeiture regulation violate the division of powers between the feds and the province? Basically meaning that under the Canadian Constitution, under Section 91, the federal government has the power to make criminal laws, and the claim here was that this was a provincial thing, therefore it fell outside of provincial jurisdiction. So on that question alone, the Supreme Court of Canada has said, with respect to whether civil forfeiture regulation is sufficiently within provincial powers, on that question alone, or should it be in federal, they've said it's provincial. So this is the Chatterley decision of 2009. They've said this legislation deals with property and civil rights. Nobody's convicted of an offense. Nobody risks being convicted of an offense. And on those pieces alone, it's within constitutional competence. And I say that because what the Canadian Supreme Court has not dealt with are the charter-based challenges. So in Canada, you have your constitutional challenges. Is it within your jurisdiction? And the second one is, does it violate the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms? We haven't gone through the Canadian Rights and Freedoms arguments. There have been bits and pieces that have come out on whether it violates charter rights, but the Supreme Court of Canada has said nothing as yet on the civil regime with respect to the violation of possible violations of rights. So some of the things they have said or that we have seen the court say about in the context of debating about these regimes are things like, so for example, when I noted what some things lower courts have said, often the courts are saying, look, these forfeitures are not in the interests of justice. And when they say they're not in the interests of justice, one of the themes that you can sort of see there is when they see the lack of a clear proportional connection between what you're taking, right, and the underlying alleged crime. So there's a couple of cases where guys were allegedly selling a couple of grams of hash from an expensive car. And in those cases, they would say, look, yeah, okay, we have some evidence of of one sale, maybe, of hash. But really, in comparison to this valuable car, right, you're really going to take my Jaguar. In those cases, they said, look, it's not in the interest of justice to do so. So they've sort of been saying that, look, when there's a lack of proportionality between the underlying allegations, what the specific crime is, and the property, they've said, that is not in the interest of justice. So that's sort of one theme that's emerged from the cases. As I said, there's no clear message that violates charter rights, such as the presumption of innocence or double jeopardy, or any of the collection of criminal legal rights that apply with respect to the charter. I would note, though, if you're following this, one of the ongoing battles that we have, which is kind of interesting, is in the province of British Columbia. And in the province of British Columbia, it's a battle between the state and the Hell's Angels gang, which is sort of our... we have many criminal gangs, but that's one of them. That's one of them that's on the West Coast. And in 2007, the province of British Columbia seized one of their clubhouses. And since 2007, there's been political wrangling, there's been wranglings through the courts. I think there's probably 9 decisions going up to the British Columbia Court of Appeal, all about the state trying to take this clubhouse. And they're trying to take this clubhouse as an instrument of crime. This is the place where they were allegedly organizing their drug sales, organizing their all of their nasty activities. And those battles have been ongoing. And part of those battles includes charter arguments. But we haven't seen those come up yet, because as I said, there are 9 actions, and in part there are things like, well, all the things you'd be familiar with as practitioners, in terms of like you're naming the wrong parties, or it's the wrong venue, or you know, striking out different statements and statement of claim, et cetera. So that's, it should go to the Supreme Court soon, you know, within the next couple of years, and of course, and that, so then that should give us some sense of, are there violations, or do they see violations of particular charter rights in that case? So, so that's sort of the framework. The project that I wanted to speak to you about briefly is one that we're doing, with respect to civil forfeiture, and it comes from this idea that when you look at the popular discourse in Canada on these kind of on this kind of legislation, by popular discourse, yes, I would include the media, but I would also include many statements in the political arena about why this stuff is a good thing and why we're doing it. It's also in popular discourse, many lawyers who are advancing the arguments in British Columbia make a number of statements about civil forfeiture regulation. And part of this project was just to say, okay, are any of these statements true? What's the truth here? What, when we're talking about civil forfeiture regulation, are there some facts as opposed to sort of this nice, these statements that are made that are disappearing in the public discourse? So, but one of the things you see in the popular discourse over civil forfeiture is this idea, actually the state's taken all our cars, they're taking our, you know, for drink driving offenses. In my province, of course, the popular discourse is all around taking a house for this alleged sexual offense. And in that respect, it's both used to show, look, this is working because this is a good thing because the guy's going to have nowhere to commit these offenses. And on the other side, it's being used to say, look what the state has done, look how they've gravitated beyond, right? We started going after crime and look at what we're doing. We're taking people's houses, right? So that's sort of the way it's kind of animating our understanding of civil forfeiture. So the little project that we wanted to do is this idea that any constitutional wrangling should obviously be shaped by contextual analysis of civil forfeiture. All of that means is, what are the facts? Period. What are the facts? What is the context? What are, in looking at in one jurisdiction, actually in what context are we applying this device? And that's all we wanted. That's all we wanted to do. It's actually, we've just begun. So I was saying to Colin, actually, I don't want to say any conclusions to give any statistics because we've barely begun, right? So I think we've looked at 50. So on that basis, so we've just begun to look through them. And the idea there is we're actually going through. We're looking for things like, in terms of shaping the constitutional analysis, kind of things like, okay, actually, where is this actually being applied? So we have the popular discourse saying it's being used to take people's houses and boats and cars. Is that actually the principal context in which it's occurring? Is it usually just about money? Is it often about property? And in what context are we taking that property? And also, what defenses, what's happening on the defense side? So, all that we're doing in this modest investigation, which began in 2014, in the context of these civil forfeiture actions. We're looking at a random collection of files drawn in Manitoba from 2009-2014. 2009 is when the inception of the program, we began to have civil forfeiture regulation. One reason we began in 2009 to use it, of course, is the Chatterley decision, right? Everybody had the law on the books, but they were waiting to see what would the Supreme Court of Canada say, was this within your constitutional jurisdiction? So once they said that it was, then you begin to have all of these actions. So we've taken this, the idea is to take a number of files from 2009 right through to 2014 and to mine those actual court files, right? And some of them are nice and thin and some of them are like this. But it's to look through them and say, okay, what can we gain about the context, right, that in which this is being applied? So to get some statistical evidence, what is the principal crime being alleged, right? How many of these are about cars, right? How many people? So to find out something, and it's just to offer that, right, so that when we're talking about some of these constitutional debates, there's some factual context that shapes that analysis. So basically, beginning and pulling four kinds of information: what are the crimes, what's the property, what's the evidence marshaled in support of the claim, and that the third one there is just, you always hear this, there's very little evidence, right? You got nothing here, you're taking our stuff, and you have very, very little evidence if there's any crime, and to look at some of the outcomes. So what is that project telling us? Well, again, some tentative empirical results from the project. They're very tentative, so I shouldn't be saying anything right now. But I'll give you some sense of what we're finding out so far, is that almost all of them are about drugs, period. Drugs, drug trafficking. I think there are, from the 50 that I've looked at, there are three that are not drugs. Three. They involve the theft of electronic equipment. All three of them involve, that aren't drugs, involve theft. So by and large, they're about drugs, drug trafficking, period. So that sort of, that would be one thing, which is just, which is interesting. The most common property seized is money, proceeds of crime, it's cash. It's not real estate, it's not boats, it seems to be proceeds of crime. And the other piece of that, which is kind of interesting for us, is that it's not American money or any other money, it's all Canadian money. So there have been claims that we have about, oh, this is, there's a lot of drugs being brought up from the United States, and there'd be some inclination to at least pay for some, or have some money there maybe that was of U.S. origin, or in our case also the Mexican drugs market. But there's very little indication, even in the case of massive drug operations, the proceeds are Canadian dollars. So I'm not sure, maybe that doesn't say anything, but we're not finding cash from other jurisdictions. Proceeds of crime, and there are a number of houses seized, and this is neat too. Every single house that has been seized in the few that I've examined has been a grow-op, a growth operation, and I would say a significant growth operation, meaning that there haven't been any houses. Every house that's taken has exactly the same characteristics. Every house has anywhere from 50 to 850 marijuana plants growing in it. Every house has, in terms of looking at the evidence marshaled in support, all of these houses have all of that equipment. Like, can't get around that fact. All of them, theft of electricity, right? That's a piece of the evidence. So that's brought, all in the water equipment, all of those things, right? And so the most common, so when you see these houses, so yes, houses are being taken, but all of those houses have been grow-ups, or it's pretty hard not to see them as grow-ups. And secondly, sort of the other piece that's coming at it, and this is quite, I suppose this is to be expected when we came up with money laundering, with this kind of legislation, the idea of certain regulation that protects maybe innocent property owners from having their stuff taken, much of this property is rental property, right? And if you were going to advise someone to run your grow-up, you wouldn't run it in your own house, you'd rent a house, right? Because if you're going to lose it, you might as well. And much of this property, therefore, the grow-ups are often in rented property. Now, there's some other curious pieces to that about the context of the rental property. And curious pieces, like there's an awful lot of people renting property in Manitoba who live on the West Coast. Now, we don't tend to have people in Manitoba who, for people from the West Coast, don't often invest in the central of Canada. But there's an awful lot of money, owners on the West Coast, with the houses rented in Manitoba. I'm not sure what that says, but that's just a piece of it. So it's rental property, and the owners aren't Manitoba residents. So secondly, and many of the actions that we're looking at result in default judgments. I heard this a number of years ago. I think it was in the United Kingdom. Somebody had said, you know, actually, most of these folks don't show up when you take their proceeds. And we're actually seeing the same thing here. So in many of the cases that involve strictly proceeds of crime, nobody's shown up. Nobody's filing a defense. Nobody responds. The orders are served. That's the end of the story, right? So they take it and there's really no court battle. The cases in which people have actually responded and filed statements, but as you'd anticipate, right, it's when there's a house or something, say, a house of some significant value. But there have been a number of houses where it was actually they weren't subject to rental agreements, where they result in a default judgment, just nobody showed up at all, right? So that would be... they don't respond. And there are the few cases that, so, and of course, almost all these actions are successful, right? There's just, I don't know, of the first few we've done, I think there's one that transferred jurisdiction, so we didn't follow that one, but all the rest are successful in terms of there's some piece of the resource that's actually being forfeit to the state. The only ones where there have been some sharing, there's been a little bit of sharing where there's proceeds of crime. There's been a little bit of sharing with the individuals who claim it. Some people had claimed that was employment incomes, and they were stashing them under their beds. So some of those we've resulted in, say, you know, $30,000. Maybe you kept $5,000 as alleged proceeds. Proceeds of employment as alleged employment income, and the rest was forfeit. And the other few cases where there've been some division of the asset is where the owners have come forward, right? And the owners have come forward and said, look, it's our house, and there's been some kind of negotiated settlement. But even in those cases, if the equity interest in the house was $80,000, right, you'll see a large portion of that will still be going to the state. So yes, the owners have come forward to claim it's our house and we want to defend this, but they've actually, in most cases, lose a significant amount of their equity interest because of the property's engagement with criminal activity. So all that to say, that's like I said, we're just starting, right? We're just kind of looking at this. The only thing I would say, sort of from this preliminary, is that what you clearly see, can't say clearly, it's tentative, it's preliminary. The only thing I would say is that the analysis that you're at least seeing in the public discourse, and to a certain extent, even in some of the judicial decisions, it doesn't reflect so far what the context that we're finding in looking at, as I said, on one jurisdiction in a number of randomly selected files over a period of 5 years. The context that we're seeing forfeiture applied, as I said, is the context of drugs, drugs trafficking. It's not these exceptional instances, you know, taking somebody's Lamborghini on the West Coast, or drunk driving is another one we have. In Ontario, there's a lot of discourse around, you know, the state's now taking all your cars for drunk driving under the civil forfeiture laws, right? That is certainly not what we're finding here. We're finding that it's principally about drugs. And I think... So all that to say, I think those are important pieces because, and I'm going to stop here, but I think the factual analysis is really important because when you begin to look at the original context in which we had the reliance on the civil devices, right? The reliance on the civil devices was in part because in the context of drugs, you encounter this complete inability of civil mechanisms to take proceeds or take property, right? When you look at all the things that are done, you don't have claimants. There's no victims. There are different ways in which you try to get the victims of drug trafficking offenses and people who have been users to go after those monies, right? But none of those really work. But in the context of at least drugs, if you didn't have civil powers to take houses or proceeds, the money would be, at least in my jurisdiction, the monies would be just left there. So I think it's an important piece in the context of lots of other criminal activities. You know, you might have your civil claimants, but at least in this, that factual setting is really important and ought to sort of shape the constitutional analysis. And I will stop there. And thank you so much for your attention.